your product is used somewhere, and that somewhere is an environment. Now, right from the reliability goal setting in the definition of reliability, environment is a part of what we need to consider and deal with. So it's no different when we get to product testing. Oftentimes, the reliability group or individuals are tasked with determining whether the product will work in the environment we expect it to be exposed to. And we can use this information, one, to find out, well, will it work under these range of conditions? But secondly, we can understand what kinds of failure mechanisms occur in the different environments, and we can evaluate that time to failure information as well. Now, there's all kinds of ways that products, all kinds of different products that experience a range of very different environments. And so I'm thinking of just the cell phone, for example. It has indoor use. It's static in some cases. It's connected to a power cable in some cases, so it's seeing different power signatures. It's dropped. It's exposed to moisture at different levels. It's outdoors and in worldwide sets of environments. And that list just keeps going on and on. But the idea is that will it survive across all of those different weather and use conditions or not? And so one approach is to isolate each of those stresses and test that product within just that stress. So will it work at the range of temperatures we expect it to be exposed to? Will it see minus 40 degrees C, and will it see plus 45 degrees C? And how many samples do you need to run at each of those conditions and for how long to detect whether it operates or not? It's one way of approaching it. Now, there's long lists of standards and standard ways of evaluating products for environmental considerations, and most of them are isolated. Does it affect, will it survive rainfall at certain conditions? Will it survive wind or snow load or dust and debris? Will it survive a mixed flowing gas or hazardous chemicals in the air? Those kinds of things. But oftentimes there's so many tests, and most of them have little risk of failing, but we still need to evaluate them to make sure that we're not surprised. So we use this technique called a waterfall test. So we may sequence a series of tests in part to age the product so that a ladder test can reveal a weakness, or to minimize the number of samples we need to use. So for example, I may do thermal cycling or thermal aging to degrade a seal, and then later do a water intrusion test to evaluate its ability for that older, quote, air quotes again, older seal to withstand the pressure of the water trying to get in. In some cases, we can combine tests and use multiple stresses, but it is usually preferred because that's how the customer's use of the product is going to occur, with combined stresses. But it's also harder to evaluate and to monitor. And in many cases, it's may be impossible to set up the conditions to do multiple stresses. So especially in accelerated testing. So it's a mix of different things of answering that question, will it work in its environment? So the other side of this is we need to understand what do we mean by the environment? So even just temperature. Nominally worldwide, outdoor temperatures are about 20 degrees C, 20 to 25 degrees C. So if we test at nominal temperatures, we test in our office in ambient, for example. It's pretty straightforward. But does that really evaluate the product's ability to withstand temperature and operate over the range of temperature? So what's our range? We might be 0 to 40 degrees C. So do we test just at 0 degrees C and see if it works and expose it to 40 degrees C for a while and then see if it works? Is that adequate? how many samples and how long do you keep it at that temperature? Again, it comes back to, well, what are the risks? What are the failure mechanisms? The other part, way of looking at this is, well, what's the distribution of temperatures that our customers are going to expose the product to? So worldwide, we have weather stations that have been collecting temperatures, for example, and rainfall and wind conditions for decades and decades, 50, 60 or 100 years or longer in some cases. So let's get, say, the last 10 years of weather data in the intended environment and create a histogram. And it might fit a normal distribution or some other distribution, but even a histogram will be useful for us. And then our specifications, are we at worst case, the absolute max and absolute minimum from the expected region of the world that we're working with? Or are we going to go to, say, a 90th percentile? Not quite the worst, but kind of out near the edges. And that might be a policy setting. Or you may evaluate the test over a range of conditions to find out the relationship of time to failure to the different stresses, and more like an accelerated test or physics of failure model building. Now, whatever we do it, we often are dealing with products that eventually will fail under any kind of environment. And if we use accelerated stresses, like very high temperatures, we can accelerate or replicate many years of use at lower temperatures. But whatever style we do, when it's important, when it's a relatively high risk area, I recommend that you test to failure. Find out exactly how your product responds by forcing it to fail allows you then to do the evaluation of, well, what's the failure mechanism? And on one hand, it's what can you do about it from your design point of view. But second is to make sure that the stress applied is actually giving you a relevant response in the product. So environmental testing can, the list is nearly endless of the types of things that we expose products to. In thinking through exactly how the product is used and where the risk is for it to fail, can guide your environmental test setups and planning so that you make efficient use of your samples. Likewise, though, getting good information to help your team make decisions. Combined environments, or CERT testing as some call it, is in ideal conditions or under use conditions is where all the stresses are being applied at once. Temperature, humidity, wind, sand, dust, and button pushing, the force being placed on the button, for example, all happen all at once. But in product testing, we often use just the button pushing, and we might even isolate it from the rest of the system, so we can test the buttons to see how long they'll last. But if it's got a little bit of sand in it, or it's been aged with higher temperatures for a while, the button's performance may be dramatically different. So to what extent do you combine environments in order to evaluate the effect of that combination on the product's performance? Now, sometimes we can do this by the waterfall technique, by applying some aging or conditioning prior to doing some functional test. Other cases, we can combine stresses in different chambers or in lab settings, and sometimes that takes some work to make happen. For example, I was looking at a device similar to a watch, and we were considering its ability to withstand moisture. Say a person went swimming with this device. Would it still survive? Well, the specifications called for a certain type of water, basically tap water for most parts of the world. Put it in the water for, I think it was 10 seconds, and pull it back out and see if it works. Remove any excess water from the surface and turn the system on and see if it's functional. But what we found is that we went back and looked at some of those samples after a week, is that at that point, corrosion caused failures within the the electrical functionality of the system. So, and these were products that were tested and then set aside, and we were expecting to come back and use them for something else. And when we came back to them, they weren't working. Taking them apart, we found corrosion, and it was later confirmed from a water intrusion. So the notion was, is that if we modified that water exposure test to include a, put them in a chamber at a modestly high temperature in order to promote the corrosion, we could evaluate the water ingress much more precisely than just a quick functional test. And so we sequenced some tests like that in order to promote the growth of corrosion, which would give us an indication that the seals had failed. But in some cases, we may be able to do vibration and temperature cycling simultaneously. There's chambers for doing that. And there's a range of other ones that it may take some creativity to sort out exactly how to combine the environments, short of giving them to your customers. Now, vibration testing has got a pretty rich history. There's just single-axis and multi-axis vibration testing, and they have the ability to take a product and put it on a fixture, basically on a device, and you can shake it in, say, one direction, back and forth. And it could be sinusoidal with certain frequencies, and usually those come with the ability to change the frequency. We're often evaluating or looking for those, I want to say amplitude, but that's not the right word, harmonics. I think that's the word. Oh, I know, I'm going to think of it in a moment. But it's a frequency of vibration that then gets amplified by the product, and the shaking gets very dynamic. It moves in a very large degree at a particular frequency. I want to say harmonic, but I have a seed of doubt that that's the right word. Anyway, so by controlling the frequency and the intensity, I can look for those nodes of frequencies or vibration that causes an amplification of the damage that occurs. In other cases, we may use a random vibration to simulate transportation or to explore many, many different frequencies simultaneously, and again, looking for what would fail. Some cases, we would actually try to replicate the frequencies of and types of vibrations that are seen, say, for a transportation process, or as the product is moved or installed, the types of frequencies and shocks that it would see. And typically, we try to put the product onto these this equipment, these shaker tables, that allow it to be as close to its normal use as possible. So you don't want to bolt it down in exotic ways. Use the mounting structures in its own the way the product would typically be exposed to these vibrations. So there's a lot more to that, obviously. But the idea is that I want to transfer energy into the product through this vibration, replicating as close as we can how we would actually see it in real use. Now, I've got a couple of notes on here. The G root mean squared, or gravity's root mean squared, or gravity squared by Hertz, are common measures for the vibration that we're putting into a product. There's a whole lot more to reading the frequency response or the shock response for products and so on. But the basic idea is in an environment testing, our products see vibration and they see shocks. And evaluating it to replicate its actual use or to amplify that or accelerate that slightly allows us to quickly evaluate a product to its robustness to that environment. The most common thing we do is temperature testing, and it seems like temperature is a pretty universal accelerant for all kinds of different failure mechanisms. But it's, again, we got to think through, is it a static temperature? Is it a high temperature, low temperature? Or is it thermal cycling? Or is it a very severe change in temperature? A shock, for example, which is roughly defined in some references as a few second change of or less of a 50 degree. It's 50 degrees C per minute, I think is what the rate is. If you see that much change or higher, 50 degrees C per minute, then we would call it a shock, thermal shock. Some products respond to thermal shock by fracturing or cracking. Glass, for example, or ceramic capacitors can do that. Whereas if you do it much more gently, change of temperature, it won't fracture. It won't cause the crack. But also change of temperature can cause condensation. So if you're doing thermal cycling or thermal testing of your product and you're in a humid environment, if you just open the door when the systems are hot, you may see a lot of condensation form real quickly, or vice versa. If you have a cold, I realize this when I'm in a cold environment and I walk into a building, my glasses fog up. Going from cold to warm, and I get a lot of condensation. The other thing to consider is as you test your product is, well, how much is heat is being contributed by the product itself? And so placing thermocouples in critical components and using that as a way to monitor the heat being applied to the product is usually prudent rather than just the chamber's set point measurements. The other thing to consider is if you've got a mechanical system, if you go really fast, even if it's not a temperature test per se, that motion and the amount of friction involved may inadvertently create a heat buildup. And that may not be the failure mechanism that you're looking for, is to inadvertently accelerate it by higher temperatures or change the rate of failure by using a temperature component to the test. Temperature by far is the most common for electronics. It leads to so many different failure mechanisms. And there's plenty of thermal chambers, and they're typically not expensive. But again, you got to think through, what's the temperature you're actually going to set the chamber to? Or is it when the component reaches a certain temperature? So where are you going to put the gauges, the thermocouples, for example? Another whole style of testing is electronics. In electronics and circuits moving current around, that motion of current will set up a field. And that field will interact with, it's like an antenna broadcasting. And so in some cases, regulatory agencies want to make sure that your product does not emit too many of these, too strong of a field such that it influences things like pacemakers or other equipment nearby, like a display. In other cases, it's looking at knowing that this is going to exist in the environment, that these electromagnetic fields EM noise is going to exist. Does your product respond to that? Is it shielded correctly? Does it operate even though you're seeing a noisy electromagnetic environment? And so it needs to be able to withstand what's already out there. And on the second hand, there's regulatory requirements that your product is not adversely contributing to that noisy EM environment. Another test that's related to power is the power that supports your product. Basically, your plug that goes in the wall or the generator what's the quality of that current and voltage coming in? Is it in the United States, we have 110 or 120 volt power outlets in most homes. And I know from just watching seeing the lights in my own home, and it's been storming lately, that we get flickers and dips and sags and spikes and surges and all kinds of different phenomena that create reflect in the lighting in the house changing its intensity. I know it's not good for my computer, so I have it going through surge protectors and other backup power supply to really shield my computer equipment from the wall circuit. Some parts of the world have very, very clean power, and it's very, very stable and very accurate to its very close to its specifications all the time. There's a at one time I ran across a set of documents that reports that measured the power quality in different parts of the world, including power outages, how many power outages, how many lightning strikes within a certain distance, how many dips and sags and so on. In each one of those terms are defined by the amount of change in voltage and for how long. And some are very short, like transients and spikes, might be milliseconds, but it may be very severe, maybe a 100-volt drop for 3 milliseconds. Whereas drops and sags are much longer duration, but generally not as severe. So it might be a 10% drop in voltage, but for 3 seconds. In each of those sets of conditions can have a different effect on your power supply and eventually on your product. So when I was at Hewlett-Packard, we had pretty extensive power line testing requirements to make sure not only the power supply, but the effects that got through the power supply also didn't damage or adversely affect the products. And going back to some parts of the world have very clean power, being very consistently on target. Some parts of the world have very, very dirty power, whereas they're not isolated, say, from large inductive loads, like a elevator motor lifting a load will put a huge drain on the local power. And if that gets reflected in the rest of the building, that can lead to some pretty damaging conditions for your product that's also plugged into that network. So power line testing is just another part of that environmental testing that we often have to do for our products. Last thing to consider is making sure that your equipment is actually giving you readings that are meaningful. So there's two parts to it. One is, if it says 10 volts, is it really 10 volts? It's calibration. Is it accurate? Is it, when it's hooked up to what is a known source of 10 volts, does it actually read that? But then second area is as you're making measurements of multiple things, well, what's your measurement error? Is it in the connections? Is it in the, how you interact with your product? Is it in the setup system? What's your process for making measurements such that you minimize measurement error? Oftentimes, if you haven't run a gauge R&R, a gauge repeatability and reproducibility study, just about every system I've done this with has gotten to, it's had 30% or more of the specification I'm trying to measure to was consumed by measurement error, meaning that it was not a capable measurement tool. So it may be accurate, it may be calibrated, but the process of making the measurement is contributing a significant amount of error. And so it's something to keep in mind as you're setting up and planning for not only environmental testing, but for any kind of testing that you're conducting. I know in the Certified Quality Engineers body of knowledge, they have a much larger section on measurement systems and measurement systems accuracy. So if you're interested in learning more about that, there are references for MSA, measurement system analysis techniques, of which repeatability and reproducibility are just two of five different aspects of getting a good measurement. So what's your environment? What kind of things do you do? One of the weirdest things I've heard about from one of my students is that their products were tested for susceptibility to fire ants, which were an ant that likes a low voltage field and so will eat through all kinds of seals and gaskets and so on, and thus making the product susceptible to moisture and water ingress, essentially causing them to fail pretty quickly, because they want to get closer to the source of this low voltage field that they can sense. And so there's a lab somewhere in Texas that allows you to take your product in and evaluate its ability to withstand an attack by fire ants. And that's a product I don't want to have to deal with too much, specifically running that test. But there's all kinds of things that our products get exposed to, from insects to funguses to the weather and everything in between. So if you got a weird type of test that you run for yours, please share it. I'm always looking for good stories of how we evaluate our products. So next, we're going to take a look at some of the things we do while we're doing development. How do we as reliability professionals support the design and development team through product testing?